Think about all the doctor jokes you may have heard over the years, like, doctor, doctor, there's a ringing in my ears, and the doctor says, so answer it. You might get the sense from that joke that we don't give doctors a great deal of credit for listening closely. And this hour's guest, himself a doctor, says they can do better at paying attention to patients' concerns and conditions. Ronald Epstein, MD, is the author of Attending: Medicine, Mindfulness, and Humanity. Dr. Epstein is a practicing family physician and a teacher of other physicians. He's professor of family medicine, psychiatry, and oncology at the University of Rochester School of Medicine and Dentistry in New York State. He first published the article Mindful Practice in the Journal of the American Medical Association in 1999. Dr. Epstein, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
How revolutionary was that article? I mean, was mindfulness just not considered part of medicine in the sense of mindfulness?
Well, you know, the word mindfulness really wasn't in part of the public dialogue, really, until more recently than that. And so when I started writing about mindful practice and qualities of mind of doctors in 99, it was really a new idea.
I get the sense right off the top in the book that doctors are trained extremely well, but not necessarily in knowing when to shove the training aside for a bit.
Well, I wouldn't say shove it aside, but using their whole selves, their whole minds. So I think doctors are trained very well in logical, analytic thinking and in making diagnoses. But the training in listening, both listening to patients as well as listening to themselves, is sometimes lacking.
Listening to themselves, in what sense?
Well, you know, a lot of medical work is logic, but a lot of it is intuition. And learning how to educate your own intuitions really has to do with, just to give you an example, if a patient comes in and they're depressed, it will produce some kind of reaction in you as another person, as another human being. And that reaction is really important in terms of making a diagnosis. But it's equally important for a heart disease, for example, because sometimes you'll just get a feeling that something's not quite right, and then only later have all the data to support that.
So in terms of, like, when you mentioned that somebody who comes in and they're depressed, I mean, doctors have to maintain some level of detachment, though, right?
Well, and that's where mindfulness really comes in, because it's the ability to be aware of your own thoughts and feelings, but not be consumed by them.
Oh,
and so that's a really important skill for anyone in medicine, whether you're a surgeon or a psychiatrist, to cultivate.
I want to get some terminology in here. The term attending, I mean, we've all watched ER and similar shows on television.
Right.
You know, we've got attendings and residents and interns and all that stuff.
Right.
So what is the pecking order of who's responsible for patients?
Well, the attending really is the top of the order. I mean, that's the person who's really ultimately responsible for a patient's care. And then underneath them, that you'll either have some fellows or residents if it's a teaching institution, sometimes physician assistants or nurse practitioners. And then there are medical students who, I guess, technically are at the bottom of the power hierarchy, but often have a tremendous amount to contribute.
Because they're learning and looking at this with very fresh eyes?
Well, they have what's called a beginner's mind. You know, they see a situation fresh. They're not biased by prior experience. I mean, prior experience is very useful, but sometimes it can really lead you astray.
So a couple of examples here. You were actually in medical school yourself, I think, when you saw a kidney turn blue in the operating room. What happened?
Oh, yeah. This was really notable for me. This was a really well-respected, well-known surgeon at a very good hospital. And we were in the operating room doing a delicate operation on an 18-year-old with cancer. And what it involved was removing all the lymph nodes around each kidney. So he had finished operating on the first kidney and switched sides of the table so that I had a very good view of the kidney he had just dissected. But it was still within his peripheral vision. And I mentioned to him, you know, it's difficult surgery, but I knew that something was wrong because I saw the kidney begin to turn blue. And I didn't know much as a medical student, but I generally knew that pink was good and blue was bad. So I mentioned it to the surgeon, and he basically ignored me. He was really consumed with what he was doing and didn't really regard information from a medical student as being particularly valuable. A few minutes later, I saw the kidney turning a dusky purple. And then I mentioned it to the scrub nurse next to me, who mentioned it to the intern who was the surgical assistant, who then mentioned it to the surgeon, at which point the surgeon panicked. It turned out that the kidney had twisted and blocking the blood flow, and in the process actually tore the inner lining of the artery that went to the kidney. So this is a serious issue, because if uncorrected, you could lose that kidney. And so the surgeon panicked. He was in a sweat. He tried to untwist the kidney unsuccessfully and ultimately had to call in a vascular surgeon to do a repair. And what was striking to me about the story was that this blue kidney was within the surgeon's sight, that I had mentioned it to him, and yet he was so intently focused on something else that he really ignored something that later would have seemed obvious. Contrast to other surgeons that I had observed who really seemed to be adept at seeing emerging problems and solving them before anyone else even noticed. And so that ability to have an awareness of one's own fallibility while still being confident was really lacking in that first surgeon.
All right, finally,
I felt that he wasn't mindful, whereas other surgeons I had worked with actually were more so.
Okay, we'll get a much better read, a larger look and talk about mindfulness in medicine with Dr. Ronald Epstein when we come back and talk more about his book, Attending. You can join the conversation as well. We'll be back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. On the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Dr. Ronald Epstein, doctor as in MD. He is a practicing family physician, and he is a professor of family medicine, psychiatry, and oncology at the University of Rochester. His book is called Attending: Medicine, Mindfulness, and Humanity, How to Be Mindful in the Practice of Medicine, is what he talks about in the book. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. So the case of the surgeon with the blue kidney, it sounds like it affected you a lot. Did it change your trajectory in medical school?
Well, you know, I began looking for evidence of mindfulness and mindlessness in those I was learning from. And I didn't really, you know, it wasn't a systematic study, but it just became apparent to me that there was something more to being a good doctor than simply learning facts and skills, that there was some capacity that really master clinicians had.
And there's a tale I'll get to in just a second about another surgeon who handled things well, which just raises an overall question before we get there. How fast do surgeons work? I get the feeling that time is really of the essence when you have a human body open.
Well, it is. You have to be fast because you don't want to have a patient under anesthesia for too long. But you need to be fast and accurate. So it's difficult work. That's why training is so long.
So the other case is about a surgeon who actually slowed down a bit, not moving as fast when this surgeon noticed a leaking anastomosis.
Well, yeah. So anastomosis is a connection between two things. In this case, between the aorta, the big blood vessel in the abdomen, and a synthetic graft that was being put in to repair a clogged portion of the aorta. The thing that really I noticed and that other surgical colleagues of mine have confirmed is that this ability to slow down when you should is really key to being a really good clinician. That is, you have to be on autopilot. You have to be moving quickly during some of your work, but then something captures your attention. And in surgery, it might be a leak or a bleed or something, or a blue kidney. If you're a family physician, it might be someone's mood being somehow different, or it might be the way someone describes their chest pain. Just these little things that you need to be attentive to and slow down and say, wait a second, something's not quite right here. I need to take a closer look.
So let's back up a bit with you, Dr. Epstein, and your knowledge of mindfulness apparently predates your practice of medicine, is that right?
Yeah, I was interested, you know, starting when I was quite young. I mean, I remember reading Siddhartha by Hermann Hesse when I was,
as everybody did, the 70s
or something. You know, everyone did in those days, and wondering, you know, what is this exploration of the mind like? And when I was 19, I ended up spending some time at the San Francisco Zen Center, and so the ideas of meditation and mindfulness were with me long before I went to medical school.
So for a guy who spent time in Zen centers and similar places, what was medical school like? Was this a rather rude awakening?
The word I use is jarring. I mean, there were wonderful things and wonderful people, and I learned a tremendous amount, and there were horrible things and horrible people. It was just a huge mix. But the thing that I saw that was really missing that was any consideration of who is this person who is a doctor, and how do we develop this person as a human being, not only as a skilled technician. And there was some of that, but there certainly was not enough.
Okay, you got there before I did. I was going to ask about the human being part. That comes first for you. So it's you know, be a complete person before you're a complete physician.
Well, maybe at the same time. It's too, you know, remember that people are going into medical school when they're 22, 23, 24, 25 years old. So they're still developing as human beings. But I think that providing medical students and residents and even doctors a way to enrich their lives to be more complete and bring that complete human being to the care of a patient.
Ronald Epstein, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is called Attending, Medicine, Mindfulness, and Humanity. How much of what you write about in Attending has been incorporated into the teaching at the University of Rochester?
Actually, a fair bit. Part of the reason I came to Rochester was because of an institutional climate and a particular mentor that I worked with when I came here that really emphasized the human dimension of healthcare. And that it's really part of being a scientific and competent clinician is to know the human face of medicine. And that's what's kept me here, because the culture here is different than many other medical centers.
Well,
and we do have training and communication skills. We've had that long before other medical schools did, and now required content in mindfulness training for medical students.
We've had other conversations with other medical school professors and talked about things like taking almost a literary look at patient histories or listening for the patient's stories. I mean, so yeah. There's a big trend in this, it sounds like.
Yeah, it is. It is. And this is different than you know, 20 or 30 years ago.
All right, there's a short but powerful statement early in the book. Medicine is in crisis. You're a medical doctor, so, I mean, and certainly not the first person in the last few years to say this. What do you mean when you say medicine is in crisis?
Well, I think that medicine has become fragmented in the sense that there's increased subspecialization, which is perfectly fine if specialists would actually talk to one another, but that doesn't happen enough. And also it's become production-oriented, largely for financial reasons, but it's also taken a huge toll in terms of the humanity in medical care.
Do we not yet gotten to a point where we emphasize prevention as being more important than trying to fix what could have been prevented?
That's a loaded question. The answer, of course, is yes. And my feeling is that that is at odds to some extent with the production-oriented mentality in medicine. That is, doing surgery makes hospitals more money than preventing disease.
Would this explain potentially things like the prevalence of C-sections in births now?
I wouldn't go so far as to say that that is a direct cause, because I think that particular issue is pretty complicated.
All right. So let's come back to some of the topics that you get into in the book. You write about inattentional blindness and inattentional deafness. Can you give us some examples? Probably lots of them, right?
I think the example of the blue kidney was an inattentional blindness example. But there's a video that's gone viral. I think many people have seen it, where there's a group of people throwing a basketball around, and you're asked to focus on how many passes are made of the basketball. And meanwhile, a guy in a gorilla suit walks across the scene. And most people actually don't see the gorilla because they're focusing so closely on the basketball. And I think that's a metaphor for a lot of what happens in medical discourse and dialogue. For example, I do research on communication, and I audio record conversations between doctors and patients. Doctors are really adept at picking up on physical symptoms like chest pain or back pain or something like that, shortness of breath. But when a patient mentions a psychological symptom of anxiety or depression or fear or worry, often that just flies right by the physician unnoticed and unacknowledged. So, and you can imagine that, you know, if you're a dermatologist, you'll listen much more assiduously for skin-related symptoms and potentially ignore other things that you don't, that aren't really part of your training. So it's, I think that kind of inattentional blindness really has to do with where you choose to direct your attention.
That's got to be a trick, though, and to find a balance between some of these things. And I wonder how you teach that sort of thing in medical school to make sure that you are doing your job at solving the physical condition you're presented with, but also having that almost a second set of ears on the same brain to hear the other concerns that are not necessarily in the medical field you're talking about.
Well, I actually think they are in the medical field because, for example, we know that if someone's depressed and has a heart attack, they're going to do worse than if they're not depressed. And we know that that people with anxiety disorders often don't take their medications as frequently as they should. So these things interact that, you know, if you trust your doctor, you're going to follow through with treatment. If you're suspicious or distrusting or your doctor's done something that you feel doesn't recognize who you are as a person, you're less likely to follow through with treatment. So I think these things are intimately linked.
We were talking about mindfulness and medicine with Dr. Ronald Epstein, who is an MD in practice in upstate New York and a professor in the medical school at the University of Rochester. His book is called The Tending, Medicine, Mindfulness, and Humanity. It looks like Dr. Epstein is actually going to do a close flyby of our area. He'll be in Santa Rosa January 29th, San Francisco on the 30th, Palo Alto on the 31st, talking about his book. You can join the conversation on the Jefferson Exchange now at 800-838-3760. Maybe you have a doctor attention or inattention story you'd like to share with us. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Email here from Mike in Medford wants to know if there's a different approach between MDs and DOs when dealing with patients.
Oh, yeah. So the, you know, I haven't had enough, I haven't done a formal study of this, but I have a sense that DO schools, because of their general emphasis on primary care and the whole person, may actually attract people who are more, I guess, people-oriented. But I don't really have any data to back that up.
Okay. Some data you do have, though, and you were talking about things that that patients expressed in meetings with physicians. You know, I'm feeling a little bad about this sort of thing. I have great concern. You actually hired some actors to pose as patients. What transpired there?
Well, I've done about five or six studies using actors to pose as patients. And in one, I had actors trained to portray a patient with chest pain. But the portrayal was specifically designed to confuse the doctors. That is, the symptoms were not typical of heart disease or of heartburn or of any particular disease. It had elements of many different conditions. And we wanted to see how doctors would navigate their way through this ambiguity. Also, the patients were distressed. They were anxious. And so what we noticed is that many of the doctors tried to come to a conclusion prematurely and not listen to the full extent of the patient's concerns, and also found that that very few initially expressed empathy or some human understanding of the concern, of the distress that the patient was under.
Well, given the things that doctors are expected to do, I wonder if we are asking doctors to do what we keep getting told by the neuroscientists really doesn't work, which is multitask.
Well, multitasking actually not only doesn't work, it doesn't really exist. That is, when you think you're multitasking, you're actually alternating your attention between two different tasks. Now, if those tasks are very closely related, that alternation is quite quick and you don't really lose much efficiency. But if the tasks are unrelated, for example, looking at a computer screen and looking up a medication while trying to talk with a patient about what's going on in their lives, those tasks, that kind of task switching is very inefficient and it happens slowly. And often you'll miss what a patient says. And I'll just tell you a story, a personal story. It's a little embarrassing, but there was once I was once looking up a patient's lab results on a computer, and the computer wasn't cooperating, so I had to kind of take a roundabout route. Meanwhile, the patient probably said to me that they need to leave the room to go to the bathroom or something. And then I was still looking at the computer and then read out the lab results to the patient who actually was no longer in the room.
You hadn't noticed that the patient had left.
And I hadn't noticed the patient had left. Of course, the patient came back a couple of minutes later. And I kind of realized my mistake. But that's an example of trying to multitask and thinking that you're actually doing this, whereas in fact you're just kidding yourself.
So the kind of person who is a good physician is the kind of person who can focus fairly intently on a task, though, I think, though, right?
Well, you need to be able to focus and also have a certain softness to that focus. That is the ability to be to use your peripheral vision. That would be kind of a metaphor I'd use. You know, when you're driving along, if you had tunnel vision and only saw straight ahead, you'd miss that deer that might kind of jump in from the side of the road, okay? So when you're driving, you know, and there are a lot of country roads around where I live, when you're driving, you need to be focused on the road, but also have enough of your attention and your peripheral vision so you can recognize something unexpected.
Ronald Epstein, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He is a doctor and medical school professor and has written a book called Attending, Medicine, Mindfulness, and Humanity. How much would you say then, Dr. Epstein, of a doctor's work is routine stuff that really doesn't always register on the conscious mind, like the second baseman always throwing to first?
You know, it probably depends how long you've been in practice, but for me, I would say probably, you know, 70% or 80% is kind of, you know, almost autopilot. It's routine.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really the 20 or 30% that makes a huge difference in terms of quality of care. So there are things that I do that you could train a high school student to do in an hour. But you wouldn't want a high school student to be taking care of you if you were having a heart attack. So you know, there are some things that are deceptively simple, whereas other things really require judgment and experience.
So I guess the question is, as you try to train doctors in mindfulness, how do you train to know when to switch out of autopilot?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I as part of the training that I use, you know, typically on rounds in the hospital, the attending physician will ask factual kind of questions of the students and residents. They'll say, you know, what are the three most likely causes of whatever symptom? I actually, you know, I'll do a little bit of that, but I'll also insert a question like, if there's something that you might be missing, what could it be? Or what are you assuming about this patient that might not be true? And I call those reflective questions. They kind of stop you in your tracks. You start, kind of begin to think about your own assumptions. You begin to wonder, become curious about how you might take a different view of a situation, even if it seems obvious or common.
Almost like thinking with somebody else's mind.
Well, yeah. I mean, another question I'll ask is, you know, think of a mentor, someone you respect deeply, and what would they say about the situation? So it's in a way stepping outside of yourself and adopting what the Zen people call a beginner's mind.
Okay, yeah, you mentioned beginner's mind earlier, so really to try to drop back and I don't know, think about this with youthful eyes in a way, or somebody who's not as experienced.
Yeah, setting your expertise aside for a moment so you can see a situation afresh.
So you also mentioned top-down and bottom-up thinking. How do we get into those?
Yeah, no, this is getting into cognitive neuroscience. That is how we pay attention to things and what we and how much of it is attentional choice and how much of it happens to us. So, again, using the metaphor of driving, you know, at the bottom of the hill that I live on, there's a stop sign. and I, you know, normally turn right to go to work. So here I am in the morning driving down the road, and even before I see that stop sign, mentally I'm anticipating it. So I know to pay attention to that. I know to see it. It registers. But let's say I'm driving down that same road and a deer jumps out from the side of the road. That's what's called bottom-up attention. That is it's stimulus-driven, that something happens, maybe unexpected, that captures one's attention.
Something that is literally right in front of you.
Yeah, well, it can be. But, mm-hmm. for example, even like the sound of a fire engine going by. I mean, try having a conversation, then a fire engine goes by, and your thoughts get derailed because involuntarily this bottom-up attention activates. It's like a circuit breaker, if you will.
All right, we'll talk about how to put these into practice in medicine when we come back from a break. Ronald Epstein, yep. Our guest. His book is Attending, Medicine, Mindfulness, and Humanity. Your phone calls and emails welcome when we return from this break in a minute five. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are learning a lot about how the mind of a physician works and how it might actually work a little better. Dr. Ronald Epstein is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, practicing family physician and teacher of other physicians in upstate New York, in Rochester, specifically at the University of Rochester. He's written a book called Attending, Medicine, Mindfulness, and Humanity. You can think of this as a long-off sequel to an article he published called Mindful Practice in the Journal of the American Medical Association back in 1999. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange. You might have some thoughts about how we use our minds and how you've seen physicians use their minds in your case. 800-838-3760 to join by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We're just talking about top-down and bottom-up thinking. You know, driving down the road to your stop sign every day, you're not really aware of what's going on. If something is more immediately in your attention, like the deer potentially jumping in front of the car, you're going to have to use bottom-up thinking. Can you decide when to use bottom-up thinking?
I think that you can train yourself to be more aware of these stimuli and then regulate them. So I think that, you know, because it's bottom-up, because it comes from some other place outside yourself, you can't anticipate it. You know, it's always a surprise. But I think you can learn to better incorporate that, so you don't ignore important data during your everyday work.
And there's actually an exercise in here that you suggest we stop and do, which is called 20 minutes of red. What is it, and what do we learn from it?
Yeah, this is something that was developed by someone I worked with, who was a teacher of mine in college, and his goal was really to help you see the world in different ways and new ways. And the exercise is really simple, to just spend a period of time, you know, it could be 10 minutes, it could be 20 minutes, it could be 3 days, writing down everything red that you see. But there's another twist to that, and also paying attention to your state of mind as you do this. So you're kind of looking outside into the world and also looking inside yourself. Now, people invariably notice red things that they had never noticed before, even things in their own homes or things that they wear. But the interesting part is what people discover about their own capacity for paying attention. They begin to wonder how red something has to be in order to be called red. They sometimes get competitive, you know, if they're doing this in a group, see who can get the most red things and the most unusual red things. Some people get bored. Some people get excited. Some people get anxious. And it's such a simple exercise that it really exposes your own psychological reactions to doing something new. So the analogy I often draw in medicine is that, you know, right now in Rochester in January, it's flu season. And so I'm a family doctor. I see lots of flu, you know, and during the day I'll see many people with a cough and a fever. And, you know, 9 out of 10 of them will have the flu, but 1 out of 10 of them won't. And it'll be pneumonia, or it'll be, you know, leukemia. It could be anything. And so there's this possibility that you could get so routine that, you know, you miss that one person who has something slightly different. And so beginning to see nuance and doing that intentionally becomes a mental exercise, and it really keeps you on your toes.
Well, I can see how important that would be.
This is true not just in medicine. I mean, regardless of what you do, there's always something routine and something unique about every situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you see, you can't make assumptions based on the first 5 seconds in the room. It's like, it's flu.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. So given, though, I mean, when you think about time, though, and the 20 minutes of red made me think about the time a doctor spends with patients. I mean, how rushed do clinicians feel to get onto the next room or the next patient?
The clinical pressure is real, and so you constantly have to make choices about what you pay attention to and what you don't. And it's good if you get it right most of the time or 90% of the time, but there are times when you don't get it right. And those are the times when you need to backtrack. I think that's part of the reality of clinical practice.
So what kinds of practices do you advise in helping people make a moment of mindfulness last or creating a moment of mindfulness when you're going from exam room to exam room?
I do. One is, and this is just really simple, but, you know, usually doctors go from one exam room to the next, and there's a door. It's usually closed in my office, and then I put my hand on the door handle. So what do I do at that moment? You know, I could just race into the room, but instead I choose just to take a second to take a breath and mentally set aside everything that's happened with the previous patient so that I can be mentally fresh and ready to hear what this next patient has to offer. And it sounds ridiculously simple to do, but the effect is really profound because you become a better listener. You become more present, and I think you enjoy what you're doing more. So another example that's really convenient for doctors is the physical exam. A lot of the time, a physical exam is a good time for me to begin to think and synthesize what might be going on with the patient. So it seems, you know, in one sense, I'm listening to the heart and lungs, but in another sense, I'm really taking a moment to see the whole picture.
So there's a whole chapter here on curiosity, and I wonder if that is one of the first things to go when a doctor feels stressed.
I think so, and I think that's, and it's also a tremendous loss because the best clinicians are the ones who are the most curious. They see uniqueness in a situation where the other people would see it as routine.
And there's a great story in this chapter about a doctor named C. Miller Fisher making faces in a patient's room.
This is incredible. This is a guy. He was an elderly Canadian neurologist and very well known. Basically, wrote the textbook. Was also kind of a very formal and staid guy. And so to see him, I was finishing up quite late one evening, and there he was. In the room of a patient, the room was completely dark, and he was shining a flashlight on his face and making all sorts of faces and gestures. This was a patient who was locked in. He had a large stroke that made him completely paralyzed, but it was thought that he was still able to think and hear and probably see. So he was trying to make a connection with this patient to see if by doing something he might see a flutter of an eye blink or a movement of a finger, just to see if the patient was able to respond in some way. Clearly, as you'd imagine, his family was very distraught, and they thought that they had seen some motion, but no one else really had. And so Fisher was there doing all of these outrageous things to try to elicit a response from the patient because he was curious. He was interested. He was really committed to seeing what this patient was capable of, not only what his deficits were.
And so, I mean, what he was looking at was the EEG, wasn't it? I mean,
there was an EEG machine running constantly as well, and he was able to see a little flicker on the EEG and also a flicker of an eye movement. And that gave the patient's family some validation that what they observed it was in fact true, and that the patient probably was able to hear and understand them even though he couldn't respond.
Which is a great relief. I mean, it didn't change the patient's outcome, but it certainly changed the level of relief for the family.
And they felt that their messages were getting through to him, and that was really what they wanted to know.
So you get into something called the fuzzy traces here. What are those, and how important can they be to mindfulness?
Fuzzy traces is a word that was invented by a psychologist named Valerie Reina, and it's kind of kind of like a gut feeling, kind of this vague sense that that something isn't quite right, or that you need to look further or need to explore further. And I'll just give you an example. When I was doing my pediatrics rotation as a medical student, kids would come in, and the senior pediatrician would say, gee, that kid just looks sick. Okay. Now, in medical school, we never learned a diagnosis that was look sick. Okay, you know, we learned about pneumonia or asthma or, measles and mumps and things like that. We didn't learn about look sick. So trying to deconstruct what makes one kid look sick and another kid look sick, you know, you can try to analyze it into, well, are they pale? Are they not moving so much? Are they whatever? But it's really this global impression that you first get that captures your attention. And Valerie Reina and other people who study, you know, gut feelings and intuitions and things like that, consider those really important messages in terms of decision making. Now, in clinical medicine, with its focus on being logical and rational, sometimes discounts those gut feelings, those fuzzy traces. But I think a healthy balance between gut feeling and analytical thinking really makes for the best clinicians.
All right. So people do have to find a way to
balance it.
Yeah, get in that zone. So this whole idea of needing to shift gears and change the view pervades all in the book. I mean, so how do you know, for example, when to use beginner's mind, when to slow down? I mean, when to make any of the changes that you need to do in your current state so that you are more receptive to what is going on around you?
That's a really, really good question. I think that first, what I try to do is train the capability to recognize the need to slow down. So, but how often and when exactly to do it, I think that really comes with practice. But if you don't have the capability to slow down at all, you're going to miss a lot. So I really start with the very basics.
Which are what?
Which are just recognizing when you're in autopilot mode and when you're slowing down and making some conscious decisions to do one versus the other.
So I'm curious to know when it comes to training medical students, how you find the zone as a professor behind between a student, you know, saying, gee, I don't know because they don't know the material, and I don't know because this case is unusual.
Yeah. And I think that's really important to distinguish, because if it's because the case is unusual, that may mean you may need some help. You know, you may need to look something up or ask somebody. And whereas if you feel that it's because you lack a knowledge base, then I think it really refers to a different set of tasks that you need to accomplish. So I think it's absolutely important to recognize that difference. And sometimes some things just aren't known, so aren't knowable. So, you know, there may be things that are going on that no matter how many tests you do and how many books you read and how many experts you consult, it still will remain unexplained.
There's an interesting passage in the chapter on curiosity where you talk about curiosity increasing uncertainty. And I think about this in the context of the popularity at the moment of the phrase, failure is not an option. I mean, do we need to fail sometimes, you think, to whack ourselves into the correct state of mindfulness?
Well,
I don't mean fail in terms of a patient's treatment, but fail at knowing exactly what's going on, for example.
I think that recognizing your limitations is one of the essentials of training in medicine and probably training in life. And the mistakes that I see doctors make are often because they don't recognize when they've exceeded their own limits. And so mini failures, small failures, are really important for learning. And I think they really protect you against the big failures.
Ah, okay. So that's the thing, is don't be afraid to make the little mistakes.
Exactly.
But
don't be afraid to be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And there's so much premium in medicine on being right and being right all the time that it's sometimes hard for people to admit their mistakes.
So in the midst of all you do at medical school now, I wonder if you go to Zen centers anymore. Have you maintained that practice aside from what you're doing in medical practice?
I do. And that's a, you know, it's I continue to sit every morning, and I have for the past more than 40 years. So it's just part of my daily life, and periodically I will spend a few days on retreat at a meditation center. I find it really restorative. I can't go for months at a time. I mean, it's just not part of my, not really an option at this point in my career. But I do find it to have been an important influence for me and something that sustains me.
Are practices like that specifically part of the curriculum now at the University of Rochester, or you just deal with mindfulness on a more general, less Zen level?
No, we teach medical students to meditate. Mm-hmm. They like it. They like a few minutes of quiet in the middle of the day.
No doubt, because they have probably a fairly noisy day otherwise. Yeah. The book is called Attending, Medicine, Mindfulness, and Humanity. Ronald Epstein is a family physician in upstate New York and a professor of family medicine, psychiatry, and oncology all at the University of Rochester School of Medicine and Dentistry. For the folks on the southern end of our listening area, again, we'll be in Santa Rosa on January 29th at Copperfields Books, January 30th in San Francisco at the California Pacific Medical Center, and January 31st at Books, Inc. in Palo Alto. Dr. Epstein, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you very much.
All right, take it easy.